This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey everyone, Boomer Esiason here. The NFL draft is behind us and your favorite team is now gearing up for week number one. The free Odyssey app puts you right in the middle of the pro football conversation with the biggest sports radio stations from across the country. The local voices who know your team the best, giving you their unfiltered takes on the current state of your squad. It's always football season right here on the free Odyssey app.
Real wolves are social creatures. They need and crave a group to belong to in order to survive and thrive. The same is true for your Minnesota Timberwolves. Now join host Henry Lake as he gets an inside look with another prominent member of the club. This is Life in the Pack.
Welcome to episode 3 of the Life in the Pack podcast. I'm your host, Henry Lake. In the first 2 episodes of the podcast, we chatted with head coach Chris Finch and former Timberwolves player Latrell Sprewell. Today, we chat with a difference maker who impacts the team both on and off the court with his business mind and passion to build the Minnesota Timberwolves into an NBA championship team. Mark Lori, the head of the new ownership group with the Minnesota Timberwolves, joins us today on Life in the Pack. Thanks for joining us today, Mark.
Oh, great to be here, Henry.
Hey, I'm sure that so many Wolves fans are so curious about you and your background. So let's start with taking us all the way back. You're born in Staten Island, correct?
That's correct, yep.
Okay, in New York, the oldest of 3 kids. Mm-hmm. How would you describe your early childhood in New York?
Yeah, I mean, grew up, my parents had me when they were 20 and 19. So in New York, didn't have any money growing up. Watched my dad. He wasn't around much. He worked 100 hours a week doing, you know, entrepreneurial things, you know, everything from selling vacuum cleaners door to door to, starting a consulting business and trying his hand in lots of different things. Mm-hmm. He wasn't around much. And, we didn't grow up with any real means and, was big into sports growing up. In Staten Island was a very, homogeneous, predominantly like a sort of Catholic Italian neighborhood. And, like, that's kind of where I grew up. And then when I was 11 years old, moved to New Jersey and was thrown into a school that was incredibly diverse, a very big change from where I had been. And I think that school helped shape a lot of who I am today.
Is it true that you got started going back to the 7th grade being interested in stocks?
That is correct. You know, I'd always I wasn't a good student growing up. In this school, the new school I said in New Jersey, I had to convince my parents that the school didn't give homework. So I never did homework. I never studied or anything like that, and didn't get good grades. But I had a propensity to for mathematics, mm-hmm. and just was just natural, born with it, and. I was super intrigued by the stock market at a really young age, starting to track stocks, 10 years old in a mm-hmm. little book,
I would say that's a really early age, yeah.
Yeah, and it was just, tracking stock prices, like mm-hmm. every week, open up the newspaper, find Kellogg's stock, things I knew, put the price down, learn what, it meant when it said last and open price and close price and things like that. And then, in 7th grade, started getting interested in stock options and started reading books on derivatives. And I literally would dive into any book on derivatives I could find. And, and basically, 7th, 8th, 9th grade. And that became sort of a passion that I followed and eventually went into that.
Were you alone in that in terms of having that type of passion? Or did you have any other... friends of yours that kind of were like, I get this, or were the majority of your friends kind of like that, just do your thing?
Yeah, it wasn't until college. Mm. Certainly in college found friends that had a passion for it, but no, not through high school.
I got you.
Yeah.
All right. You know, me personally, I grew up a sports car collector. And I read that there's so many amazing things you'll find on somebody's Wikipedia page, right? And I read that in high school, you started a card company called Mint.
Yep.
Do you collect cards? Because the hobby is starting to roar right back again.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, was a huge collector growing up. Started the Mint. We used to buy cases of cards direct from the manufacturers like Topps and Donruss and Fleer.
Mm-hmm.
And spent all summer putting them into full sets and sell them at trade shows and make $10 a set, right? It was like, but collected cards, had a huge collection. And then basically, I don't know, maybe a year before the new boom in card collecting,
mm-hmm.
sold the entire collection.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So basically had it for, you know, almost 40 years. And then, I guess timing's everything.
It is. Well, you know, it's interesting because, so I was one of those kids that I would get a little bit of money or stipend from cutting grass or whatever. And I come to downtown Minneapolis. We used to have this chain called Shinders. And you go there as, you know, magazine store, bookstore, but also, you know, just big on like the collectibles, right? And so I really got into it. And then I started to kind of fall out, me personally, in college, because I felt like I was getting priced out.
Yeah.
You know, when we had the refractors and it started getting kind of crazy that way, it became less of a thing for the kids and yep. more of a hobby for adults.
I agree. Same thing happened with me. It got too complex. There were so many different versions of a rookie card. I remember and loved the good old days when there was like one rookie card. You had mm-hmm. a 1975 George Brett rookie. That was, you know, his card, right? Or Robin Yount and all these guys. And then it started to be where there'd be dozens, if not, you know, 100 different rookie cards of a player. And it got very confusing and it got very expensive.
Yeah.
And just wasn't the same.
Yeah, so, I got priced out.
I got priced out too. I loved it. I'm sure. Do you have any favorite cards? Like everyone has.
Well, I have I don't have the rookie card, but I have the second year card of the Michael Jordan, the Fleer card.
Mm.
So I have that. That's one of my favorite ones. I do got some early Kobe Bryant cards and stuff like that. But I still have some cards, but I just...
Baseball? Any baseball?
Yeah, I got some baseball, some Kirby Puckies. I mean, I'm, you know, a Twins fan, a Minnesotan.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think who else. Well, I do got, I think I have... a couple of Ken Griffey Jr. rookie cards. I think that I do have an Alex Rodriguez rookie card. So I got some cards, a few.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah, but basketball was always my jam. We're talking to Minnesota Timberwolves owner Mark Lurie here on the Life in the Pack podcast. I am your host, Henry Lake. It sounds like you've always been good with numbers. As you just mentioned, you attended and graduated from Bucknell University in 1993. You were part of the track and field team, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
All right, clearly you had this spirit of being an entrepreneur, but at what age did being an entrepreneur really take off for you?
So, yeah, like many kids, but I was maybe extreme, was, you know, involved in every little entrepreneurial venture you could think of as a kid, from newspapers to recycling to lawn mowing to car washing to, like, you know, set all these baseball cards. And but when I went to college and graduated, there really wasn't this opportunity to go work for a startup. Mm. I didn't have any money to do my own startup, and it wasn't just a thing. You didn't go work for a startup. I went to work for a bank because I had been involved in stocks and knew that area and liked it. But after about, I don't know, 7 years in banking, I saw what was happening in the stock market with the sort of whole internet boom. You know, this is right up until about to 2000 when it burst, but leading up into that.
Mm-hmm.
And saw these startups being started, and just, I don't know, felt like it was the right time. It was like my calling to be an entrepreneur, and I knew I couldn't be in banking anymore. I was making a lot of money. I just had a baby at the time, and so it wasn't the ideal conditions, but I just had to do it. And so one day I just walked in my boss's office and said, I'm gonna quit and become an entrepreneur. You know, no idea.
Yeah.
No capital, but I just knew I had to do it. It just felt right, and struggled definitely in the beginning. But then that was in 2000. But the last 20 years has been a great ride, and learned a ton. And have done a lot of startups over that time.
Well, you know, I was going to ask about that. I want to follow up there because, you know, we hear so much about the successes, right? Like, because everybody that's extremely successful, they've had some obstacles, they've had some failures. I guess, what would you say was the biggest obstacle or failure in whatever endeavor that you learned from the most?
Yeah, I mean, like, there were failures along the way in every startup. Every startup, you know, got down to, you know, a few weeks cash left in the bank sort of thing. So even the ones that worked really well, there's always that point in time where you're thinking whether or not it's going to make it, you know. And I often talked about this, what I call sixth gear. It's sort of like making failure not an option, like where you're willing to do whatever it takes work-wise to pull it out. And I think, you know, in every startup, it always comes down to that, it seems. I haven't been a part of a startup to date necessarily where it just is great from the beginning and just gets better and better and better, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And it typically doesn't work that way. It's always very hard to raise money. It's very hard to hire great people. And, you know, startups by definition are going after segments of the market that have a low probability of success with big outcome. And anytime, you know, you have a low probability of success, you're going to be in for it.
Yeah,
you know?
I hear that. I was a media press assistant for the 1996 Olympic basketball competition. And I'm wondering, is it true that in 1996 you qualified for the U.S. national bobsled team, which would compete in the 98 Winter Olympics?
That is true.
Man, so...
Yeah, the national team, yeah, that would have been the Olympic team 2 years later.
Yeah, so tell me about that experience.
That was crazy. So, I was... a track athlete, Division One, and sprinter, and maybe I don't know, 2 years after I started working, was down at the World Financial Center, and the U.S. National Bobsled team was visiting different cities. Were there for a week and allowed people to push the sled and be timed to try and raise awareness for bobsled. And they said the fastest time during the week would get invited to kind of see what's going on in Lake Placid, like just whatever. And so I one day after work, after lunch, went down there and put some shoes on in my you know work outfit, proceeded to push the sled and had a good time. And they seemed excited about it. And that was it. And then I got a call like a couple weeks later saying, hey, just wanted to inform you, in New York City, you pushed the sled. I said, yeah, you had the fastest time of the week. Would you like to come to Lake Placid? And I said, well, what does that mean? Well, you come up to Lake Placid and we'll put you through a battery of tests, and if you pass the tests, we'll train you for a month, and you could, you know, potentially compete, you know, to get a spot on the national team. And I got a tentative time off work. I didn't know if I was going to pass the test, but I went up to Lake Placid, and it was all sprint and drill and jumping and strength and all kinds of tests and things, and you had a score of 700, and I scored 7-something. It was over it, and they said, hey, you passed this test. Welcome. You can stay here for a month and train with us, and you know, go to the trials. Now, mind you, this wasn't pushing this. I mean, driving the sled. It was just pushing it. Mm-hmm. So it was just speed and strength. There wasn't a lot of technique. But I spent a month in Lake Placid learning how to push the sled, and then there was the time trials, and you had to finish in the top 13 to make the team, and I finished 13th, and it was kind of a shock. And I remember being in a room and they're like, okay, welcome to the U.S. National Bobsled team.
That's awesome.
This was 2 years before the Olympics, and they were talking about traveling around the world and going here and there and everything. And I had a big decision to make. I was, you know, a couple years into my career and things were going well. Did I want to take the next 2 years off? You know, I certainly wasn't going to be in the number one sled or anything like that. And I decided, no, I'm going to, it was a great experience. Loved it. But I'm going to stick to my job.
Do something else, yeah. You've been an extremely successful businessman in your life. Why the NBA? What are the things that drew you to the league and the Timberwolves organization?
Yeah, first of all, I mean, I just love what the league's doing and Adam Silver, and I think it's a more progressive than other sports. It's global. I love the, how advanced, thinking, in terms of diversity, in terms of, like, addressing social issues. Like it seems much more advanced than some of the other leagues. And I think it's got a lot of upside as a league itself. The game is super exciting. It's fast-paced, a lot of action. I played every sport growing up except basketball, which is just really ironic. I loved watching basketball. It's just one of those things, your sport, your team, I'm sorry, your school, your friends, you never really played basketball. But I loved watching it. I was a huge Knicks fan growing up. They're still my second favorite team now.
I got you.
But, just 2 months ago, I just started picking up basketball. So I thought, you know, it'd be a really fun sport to learn how to play.
I see you've been getting up shots.
Yeah.
You've been posting the videos.
It's hard. I've been doing it like five days a week for like the last 10 weeks. And, it's a tough sport. It definitely takes a toll on your body, which is part of the reason to sort of learn and stuff, and just to be able to connect more with the players and understand the game better on the ground, and you know what it feels like to be out there, you know. But it's been fun.
How would you categorize the process of being an NBA owner?
The process. It wasn't as much of a process as you would think, like where typically you would say, okay, what are all the, you know, what sport do I want to be in? Okay, NBA, what team do you, like that sort of a, it wasn't like that. It was sort of like, hey, Glenn Taylor, would you be open to talking to him? That's how it started. And Alex and I like, sure, we'll talk to him. And then we sort of just fell in love with the team and Glenn and Becky and just everything within a very short period of time.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, days later, like we had sort of committed to doing a deal. So it happened really fast. It wasn't much of a process. It was more, you know, emotional and more missionary. It wasn't, you know, we're not buying the team to sort of as an investment to make money. I mean, that's great if it grows in value, and I'm sure it will, but it's more of a missionary type of opportunity. Like it's a chance to get involved in something bigger than yourself and to have fun. And, I think there's a good chance here we could really impact the collective happiness of all the stakeholders, you know, the fans, the players, people working at the organization, the community. Like I see a real opportunity to positively impact those groups. Yeah. And that's always fun. That's really drives me, you know, the ability to, I'm a pleaser by nature. Like I grew up that way. It's like, want to make people happy at the end of the day. And I see a real opportunity. And Alex does too. We're very similar in that way.
Yeah. We're talking to new Timberwolves owner Mark Lowry here on the Life in the Pack podcast here. Henry Lake hosting here today for episode number 3. Speaking of A-Rod or Alex Rodriguez, when and where did your friendship begin?
It was over a year ago, like a year and a half ago, I think. We were introduced by a mutual friend. And it was more just to get to know you. And we immediately connected, you know, and realized, you know, we both had two daughters. We grew up in a similar way from humble beginnings and loved sports, loved business, entrepreneurship. We shared a common set of values. We were talking about transparency and being open. And just on the first conversation, it was pretty cool. And then he quickly opened up about he was far along in the process of buying the Mets and, you know, said if I was interested, and I'm, you know, big baseball fan, and you know, sort of joined him late in that process, and we got to know each other, like because it was like thrown into it. You know, we were talking every day for months leading up to the final deal announcement, and we didn't get that, but you know, we started, you know, building businesses together, being friends, doing things, hanging out, and we you know, said that it was probably a reason why the Mets didn't work out, and we both felt confident there was something bigger, better for us, and then here we are. And looking back, it's funny now. Like this happens a lot to people. You know, you hear these stories, but it truly was like a blessing that didn't work out. Mm-hmm. 'Cause like this is so much better of a fit for us, and we couldn't be happier.
Yeah. The fans in Minnesota, they've been starving to root for a contending team for many years. Any pressure you feel of being one of the new guys with Alex to get that part done?
There's always that sense of pressure that sort of drives you. It's healthy pressure though. It's not, you know, it's just fun to wanna want to make a difference and want to make a difference quickly. We're going through and sort of applying the same playbook we would in startups. You know, it's called VCP, Vision Capital People, and it's putting in hundreds of hours with a collective team to clearly articulate what do we want to be in 10, 15, 20 years? Mm-hmm. How are we going to get there? What is the right organizational structure to support that? What are the key success metrics? Get that all down on paper. What kind of culture do we want to build? What's our mission? What are our values? How are we going to live these values like no other team in the league? How do we create the right incentive structure? And then building a sort of financial capital plan to support that. And kind of getting that all, and it's hundreds of hours of time, and typically takes 6 to 12 months to do it right. And then once that's in place, start, you know, putting the right people in the right spots. And, you know, hopefully it won't be one of those sort of revolving door type situations. Because mm-hmm. if you know who you are and you know the kind of people you're looking for and you've got the right structure and you bring the right people in, that they'll stay there for a long time.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the goal, is to build a long-term, you know, world-class, admired organization that continues to build and grow over time. And I have no doubt that if we put the time in, that it'll work out and everyone will be happy with the results.
You got a ton of fans. You got a ton of fans, the Timberwolves fans all over. I mean, some celebrities. You met one last night in Craig Kilborn here at the game. I mean, what was that like meeting him last night?
Yeah, great. I've met him before.
Uh-huh.
I think it was at the Lakers game we chatted. But, it's great. He's a huge fan, and it's great to get his support behind the team. And he had some words of advice, and I look forward to continuing to talk to him.
All right, so I got to ask you about this. I came across this. So you beat NFL Hall of Famer Jerry Rice in a race once. What was that about?
It was a 40-yard dash. It was for charity.
Okay.
It was St. Jude. So,
about how many years ago?
This was 2 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, 2 years ago. Yeah, I guess Rich Eisen, you know, he does this 40-yard dash.
I met him. I love him.
Combine.
Yep, for
great,
the combine. Yep.
Great guy. He's been doing this for St. Jude every year for, I think, maybe 15, 20 years, something like that. And I got involved a few years ago and went there with him and made a donation and raced the 40, and it was a lot of fun. And I told him, hey, you know, let's make this bigger. Let's, you know, bring in, you know, athletes and other people and try to raise more money. And so that next year we brought in Jerry Rice to run the 40. And then last year we had eight, you know, NFL stars,
mm-hmm.
you know, we had Michael Vick there last year. We had, you know, Terrell Davis and Chris Carter and Jerry Rice and Ray Lewis and, Rod Woodson and these guys. And they all ran the 40.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this year it's coming up again and hopefully it'll be even bigger. We raised almost $2 million last year for St. Jude. And so it's a great cause. And hopefully we'll continue to be able to build it out and get some more professional athletes involved in that.
Nice. All right, I got two final questions for you. Outside of business, what does Mark Lurie like to do?
First of all, a lot of the stuff I do in business is just fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's like part of my passion. I would say but outside of like business stuff, you know, I'm building the city. That's super fun project. That's multi-decades.
And what's the correct pronunciation of the city?
Tolosa, yeah. But I would say I love magic. So I sort of like to perform magic. That's sort of fun. I love playing blackjack. I do that quite a bit. Love horse racing and playing basketball now.
Yeah.
Definitely. I'm really enjoying, like, I have, you know, a lesson again today. I hired Phil Beckner, the NBA player development coach, to train me, you know, because if I'm going to do it, I'm going to go with the best. And I really look forward to it every day. Like, if I don't have basketball practice, I'm kind of depressed. Like, that's how much I love it.
Yeah.
It's so fun.
Well, when the racing season starts again here in the spring, when we get up to the, you know, the Derby stuff, whatever, me and you will have to sit down and go over the PPs, the past performances, and take a look at some of the. I'm big into horse racing.
Oh, great.
Yeah. All right. So the last one, then we'll let you go. What kind of owner would you describe yourself as being? Because you seem like a pretty laid back guy.
Yeah. What kind? I mean, you know, it's sort of a, you know, it's about empowering people.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe in sort of the VCP model. Spent a lot of time on the vision and strategy, but once that's set, it's about culture and people. It's about building an organization that the very best people in the world want to come and work. They love being there. They're motivated to give the very best they've got. Like, if you got a clear vision and strategy, and you've got a culture that brings in and motivates the very best people in the world, you can't lose. Like, that's the mentality. And so I'm more the type of owner that's going to focus on the culture and sort of vision strategy and really focus, spin all, and not micromanage, really empower people. I'm very, and Alex is too, we're very values oriented and very focused on wanting people to have a great experience with the organization, whether you're a fan, part of the community, an agent, media, player, person in the, like, everyone should have a great experience. Everyone should feel good about it, And that's a values-based organization.
Well, one of the funny things that I observed early, like the first week of the season, I want to say, was I was sitting there in my seat on press row, and you were in the aisle there, and there was a gentleman, a season ticket holder, that walks up to you because you were standing, and he kind of like tapped you on the shoulder. Was like, "Sir, could you please sit down?" Not knowing it was you, and you were just like, "Oh, my bad. I'm sorry. I apologize. Whatever." But that was kind of a funny moment. Everybody's looking around like, "You just told Mark Lurie to sit down." But that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm pretty laid back, and like I don't want to be treated differently. Abide by the rules, and don't want to do anything that. Wouldn't ask a fan to do or anyone, It's just
so. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate having you on Life in the Pack.
Thank you, Henry. It was great. Great.
Appreciate it.
Hey, everyone. Boomer Esiason here. The NFL Draft is behind us, and your favorite team is now gearing up for week number one. The free Odyssey app puts you right in the middle of the pro football conversation with the biggest sports radio stations from across the country. The local voices who know your team the best, giving you their unfiltered takes on the current state of your squad. It's always football season right here on the free Odyssey app.